Chapter 10, Globalization of Business, Good or Bad? In this chapter, we will explain the meaning of globalization. We'll outline the sources that are leading to changes in the scope of globalization. We'll identify the range of competing views as to the nature of globalization. And we'll explore the ethical dilemmas that arise out of global business activity. Firstly, what is globalization? Globalization is more than simply international trade in goods and services, although that is a highly significant part of globalization. If goods and services flow across borders, so does capital, investment flows. Particularly in the 20th century and 21st century, increasingly the financialization of the global economy has seen very large flows of speculative money, often referred to as hot money, flooding across borders where people are seeking to gain high interest rates, high profit margins, etc., in different parts of the world. One controversial aspect of globalization is that if goods and services and capital is free to flow across borders, so will labor be. And international migration is a big issue which has gained particular prevalence in the last 10 years. Because globalization has been fueled by the rise in the ICT revolution. With the spread of the internet and ICT technologies mean that communication flows now are almost instantaneous across borders. Last but not least, we have cultural flows. If people are flowing across borders, that does mean that hitherto cultures which have proceeded, if not in isolation, at least in relative isolation compared to other cultures, now, with people flowing across borders, it does mean there's much more intermingling of cultures. This, of course, has huge political ramifications. But in terms of business, it means that we're now likely to have workplaces which have people from many different faiths, many different ethnicities, many different cultural backgrounds. And this is something which, of course, in HR policies, businesses have to deal with in terms of cross-cultural management. In Chapter 3, we looked at the whole issue of technology, and we saw that technological change and globalization are often bracketed together as being seen as the great hopes for the future of humanity. And of course, globalization means that technology is free to grow across borders. And there's a big debate there as to whether or not that leads to a flattening of the world. In other words, a coming together of poor countries and rich countries, or whether or not that would lead to a divergence between countries. Is globalization inevitable? Well, interesting at the moment in 2018, looking back in the past, the World Bank most often distinguishes three ways of globalization. The first major wave of globalization was in the 18th and 19th centuries, and that was very much fueled by the imperialist expansion of countries like Britain, France, Germany, and then, of course, in the later part of the 18th century and the 19th century by the United States of America. There should be nothing inevitable about globalization, as witnessed by the period, the interwar period between the First World War and the Second World War, when globalization was very much in retreat. And what started to happen was, rather than countries competing and cooperating with each other internationally, they started to look inwards, sought to protect themselves from foreign influences and foreign trade. And of course, that led, many people would argue, to the causes of both the First World War and the Second World War. So people see that as the era of the retreat of globalization. After the Second World War, particularly in the West, particularly in the so-called developed world or First World, globalization has been exponential. And we have lived in a rapid wave of globalization, so much so that, as we saw in chapters 2 and 3, people began to talk about the rise of the Washington Consensus. People began to talk about the triumph of the market, and people began to see it as inevitable that globalization and technological flows would continue unabated through the power of the market. But recently, and especially since the global financial crisis of 2008, we've begun to see a reassessment of that cozy optimistic view. And of course, here we are in 2018 with the election of Donald Trump in America, talking about let's make America great again, and let's put America first. If we look at what's been happening in terms of Britain, in terms of Brexit, Britain coming out of ostensibly one of the biggest free markets in the world, but arguing that it's going to have an advantage in even having a bigger free market, a global free market, And then seeing the policies of China, which is now moved from being a country which was very pessimistic about globalization to a country which is now embracing globalization through the One Belt, One Road policy of Xi Jinping. We're at an interesting crossroads in terms of what's going to happen. Are we going to see the increase in globalization, or are we going to see a fragmentation of the world economy into different power groups, each trying to carve out their own spheres of influence? This is a major debating point in terms of current globalization theory. A major part of the chapter then concentrates on looking at the different perspectives in globalization. It's clear that for neoclassical writers, globalization is good. Based on the economic theory of comparative advantage, which you will explore in the chapter, it's argued that trade between nations will always be mutually beneficial. In other words, both partners or all partners will gain from trade. And it's worth your while, when you're reading the chapter, spending a little bit of time and just studying that particular theory, which was first developed by David Ricardo, a British economist in the 19th century. You'll see that the theory of comparative advantage, neoclassical theory of trade, sits very, very comfortably with the broader neoclassical beliefs as embodied by the Washington Consensus, which we explored in Chapter 2. In other words, for neoclassical economists, globalization is an unremitting good that will always lead to good things. Marxists, on the other hand, are very sceptical. Starting with Marx in the 19th century, particularly towards the end of Marx's life, Marx became very critical, particularly of imperialism, and he began to argue that what trade was doing in the form of imperialism was essentially unequal, that it was lining the pockets of the rich conquering powers, the colonial powers, at the expense of the colonies. And for many people, the same processes that were taking place in the 19th century, whereby rich countries dominated poor countries, or now rich countries and indeed rich multinational global corporations come to dominate poor countries. So the same processes argue, it is argued by Marxists are in operation. Structuralists, on the other hand, take a more balanced view about globalization. Globalization could be a good thing, provided that it is regulated in a proper way. A pivotal figure in the structuralist movement is Amartya Sen, a Bengali Indian economist, although he spent much of his working life in the West. Sen argued that particularly for developing countries, we can't really talk about industrialization as a movement that those countries are going through, but what he terms late industrialization, because poor countries, developing countries, previously colonized economies, countries, because they are coming late to the trading game, it means they're up against pre-existing structures and institutions which benefit the West, benefit the developed world. Therefore, if globalization is going to work in such a way as to be even and bringing about mutual benefits for all countries, particularly in relationship between rich and poor countries, there needs to be the creation of a level playing field. In economic theory, one of the major theories which challenged the cozy neoclassical view that international trade would always be a good thing was the Prebisch-Singer hypothesis, which was developed in the 1970s. What Prebisch-Singer discovered empirically was that for countries that specialised in primary goods, which were predominantly poor countries, developing countries, they were at a competitive disadvantage. If we remember in Chapter 2, the concept of elasticity of demand, Prebisch-Singer argued that because third world countries, developing countries, specialise in primary goods, the big problem there is the nature of demand for primary goods is inelastic. Effectively, what that means is the more that they produce, the lower and lower and lower prices are. So actually, paradoxically, the more successful they are in trade, the less they earn in terms of trade revenue. This means that automatically there's an advantage for countries which specialise in manufactured goods and a disadvantage for countries that specialise in primary goods. So this automatically then drives a theoretical wedge in the neoclassical belief that trade will always be a good thing. Building up from that theoretical analysis, then structuralists begin to point to a wide range of other structural weaknesses which they argue militate against the chances of third world countries sharing inclusively in globalisation. They argue that in the Third World, very often corporations suffer from poor governance, there's existence of corruption. They argue that there is asymmetric information in the sense that First World countries, who are buying primary commodities, often have much more market information than the poorer countries, which puts them at a competitive advantage. All too often, there may be missing markets. For example, poor farmers might not have access to insurance or to credit or to infrastructure so they can get the goods to market. So in other words, what's needed is a whole range of structural reforms to support markets if globalization is going to work for the global good. Of course, the big pivotal event in the globalization debate has been the 2008 financial crisis. What the financial crisis did was show the limits to the market and particularly showed the difficulties in terms of establishing equal and fair trading relationships between first and third world countries. If we put that on top of a range of ethical concerns that people have had about globalization, businesses operating in different markets and in different countries with different levels of development, it all meant that at the moment globalization is subject to an awful lot of analysis and scrutiny, which we explore in the chapter. To sum up the chapter then, we can see that what globalization does is it links economies together across all the various spatial levels. Effectively, we're looking at the expansion of capitalism on a world scale. There are competing views about globalization ranging from good, bad, or it depends. What's certain is that globalization is a challenge for business, both in an operational and a strategic way, and that we must be mindful when viewing globalization to take into consideration the full range of ethical concerns.